Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a weekly podcast to keep you up to date on what's new on our cloud platform, Microsoft Azure. Your hosts, Cynthia Crane, Evan Basilik, Sujit DeMello, Kendall Roden, Kel Teeter, and Russell Young discuss a different service or solution on each show, with subject matter experts to explain how to get started, how different services work, and how to make decisions in tricky scenarios. You can find out more about our podcast at azpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter at Azure Podcast.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 308, being recorded on the 11th of December, 2019, with special guest Jia Feng. I'm Sujit, and on Teams, we have, of course, our special guest Jia, Kendall, Kale, and Evan. And thank you all for joining us on this, I guess, a doubleheader week for us. We did a show a couple of days ago and another show today. But Kale, I noticed you put some updates in the show notes. Anything that you want to talk about
there? Yeah, sure. I'll go through these quickly. But the first one was around Azure Sphere, which is basically, I think there's an upcoming webinar that you can register for up here with the VP of IoT and mixed reality coming on to talk a little bit about brownfield IoT, which for those who might not understand that term, so in the IoT space specifically, like when we have a lot of devices, it's not so easy for someone to say, well, I'm going to switch to this other, you know, like a cloud platform or something like this, and oh yeah, I got to replace all my devices. That's not easy when you have millions of devices or something like this. You know, there's an actual physical piece of hardware here. So the brownfield is kind of retrofitting or an option to allow people to use existing kind of IoT infrastructure and devices along with something new that we have here in IoT as part of our suite. And Azure Sphere obviously is bringing the secure envelope around that. So it's a pretty good, nice little write-up here. And there's a webinar to talk a little bit about some of the new devices that were announced at Build. Specifically, they talk about the Starbucks IoT scenario with the coffee machines being one of those they're kind of highlighting. But it's pretty interesting kind of article for those who are into the IoT space.
That's not, are you telling me we're not going to have the baristas anymore now?
No, it's more about, you know, smart devices. So like coffee machines being able to report back, you know, water temperature, bean quality, all the kind of different like pieces of info that they do analytics on kind of thing.
And something else that they said was really cool is that it helps them push all the recipes to all the espresso machines. So when like it's pumpkin spice latte season, the same unified like recipes gets pushed down to all of their espresso machines.
I'd be okay if they just delete that recipe.
And all the other ones you might like too.
That's what I'm talking about right there. See, cool. That's great. Thank you, Cynthia, for joining us.
Few other ones here. There's an update here about the maintenance control for platform updates, which basically allows customers to control some of the impactful host updates that are coming down and how they can kind of schedule that stuff, which has been a big thing for a while with customers, especially when you go to cloud. When you're on-prem, typically you can hug your servers when you get home at night, but you can't do that as much in the cloud, right? So when an update comes down, especially if it's something critical, if you have a critical business workload running on there, you just don't want machines rebooting willy-nilly. And this is a way for customers to kind of schedule that stuff out so that they can better control.
I think this is huge, I think, right, Evan? I'm sure you must be saying this a lot.
Yeah, because I've been doing this platform for a long time. I remember when we said, don't worry about updates. It'll just be transparent all the time. And then the real world cropped in and we realized that there's workloads that are super sensitive and, you know, and the, you know, 1%, you know, 0.1% failures is still, you know, thousands of machines. And so this is a big deal because we rolled out in, I guess, about this time last year, I may be wrong on the timeline, but the ability, when we have predictive maintenance coming through to delay it, like this, but this is kind of stuff that we're doing hardware deprecation, that kind of stuff. This is even tighter where, you know, we're rolling out some update underneath, some software update, and you can block, you know, kind of limit your time window on that. And that, so yeah, no, that this is, a massive change.
No, I remember a while ago, maybe in one of our internal conferences, but Mark Rasinovich talked about this idea where updates of this nature will be like the machine is just frozen for like a couple of seconds, the update is applied, and then the machine is unfrozen. So in that scenario, does the customer really have to worry about it? I mean, other than a 2 second delay?
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. Is it turns out in the real world, there are lots and lots and lots of workloads that care about that. You know, I'll just as an example, because I think we're talking a little bit later about Xbox Live, but like Xbox is a good example. If I'm playing, you know, my buddies and I are playing Gears of War 5 right now, and you know, if I'm playing on the weekend with them and I get a 2 second freeze on my side, I'm toast. Right, it's gone. That makes a huge difference.
That's true. You know? Yeah, so like, even with databases and all that, it could make a difference.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, if the 2 seconds is something that if you're in the browser, right, you will know. I think anything more than a second, you notice. If my memory is right, but you know, so yeah, in the grand scheme of things, yeah, most workloads don't notice, don't care, but there is enough that do that. This was an important feature, but it took us a while to kind of grasp that and then figure out the right way to do it. But yeah, this is a big, big step.
Yep. Two other ones quickly we'll go through here and then we can get to our guest. Is there was one about specifically about 5G network computing and how Microsoft has been kind of involved early stages with some of this stuff. So specifically around like edge computing and having these, I guess they call them network edge, but they basically have rolled some of this out with our partner AT&T. Who's obviously heavily involved in the 5G rollout and next generation networks. And so basically being able to not only do things in our cloud platform, but be connected to even closer to Evan's point, things like gaming or something that's very, very low latency, getting that network as fast as possible and being able to cut out points of access in between there is critical. And so like it's pretty cool to see we're working closely with all these partners with our edge computing so that you can experience both all the stuff that's great in public Azure and beyond, but also these edge and kind of hybrid scenarios. And the last one I had was actually about Xbox. There's a pretty cool write-up here from one of the marketing managers about site reliability best practices, and they're talking specifically about things that they considered in Project xCloud. For those who don't know, that's a game streaming service for Xbox. I think it's in actually beta right now. You can basically go play your Xbox remotely on your device, whether it be like a phone or a tablet or whatnot. And it was really around what are the things they had to consider and what are the key points they talk about using AKS behind the services that are running this, as well as some of the features we have native to Azure, like our own templates and things, to make things more resilient, make things more predictable as they need to kind of scale these things without customers kind of noticing.
Great. Thanks a lot, Gail. Those are a really good set of updates. I thought we'd have nothing to talk about, so I was wrong. But those are good. Thank you. Well, without further ado, let's get to our special guest. Hey, Gia, thanks for joining us today. Can you give us a little bit of background about yourself, what you do at Microsoft, and what's your passion in the Azure space here?
Sure. Yeah, I'm Gia Fan. I'm product manager for Azure Data Share. I'm really excited to be here to actually talk to you guys about a new service we just launched in July, and Jada Ignite.
So I know I heard the announcement, but I have to be honest, I don't know what exactly makes Azure Data Share different from, say, I guess my OneDrive share or something like that. Go ahead, explain that to us.
Yeah, sure. So the goal for Azure Data Share is to make cross-organization data sharing really easy and secure in Azure. And a lot of our customers are using the service for big data sharing. So it's not about, sharing a single Office document, but to share time series data, large data files, or even databases for analytics purposes. So that is really why they're looking for ways to share those data more easily and securely in Azure. We actually, talked to our customer about how they're sharing data today. And most of them, guess what? They're using secure FTP. And some of them are building APIs or use emails or USBs to share data. And all these technologies have their, you know, drawbacks. For example, for FTP, you have to set up the FTP infrastructure. For API, you have to develop code. Email certainly is not very scalable for sharing large amount of data and on a regular basis. And USB, you can imagine that you even have to ship it physically to your partners or customers. So this is why we developed this Azure Data Share product to make data share really easy Azure to Azure, because a lot of the customer we're talking to, they already are using Azure and their partners, a customer also in Azure. So they come to Microsoft and asking us, you know, how can we make it easier, Microsoft? So this is why we developed this product.
And how is this different from, you know, like, let's say if I upload something to Blob Storage and create a SAS token URL, you know, for it and share that with others? Like what's wrong with that scenario?
Yeah, so we actually have some customer there doing that today. And what they told us is, you know, when you try to share a SAS token, it's really not trackable. So the recipient can give the SAS token away to someone else, and you really don't know who's accessing your data. And on top of that, there's no central or easy way to keep track of which token you have given to who. So some of our customers, they're actually creating spreadsheets to try to keep track of, you know, which is given to who. So they're really looking for an easier way to kind of manage the sharing. So with the Azure Data Share service, what we do, maybe let me tell you just how it works, is the data provider, they can go to a very simple user interface to select, you know, which data set I want to share. It can be, you know, files, folders, or SQL tables and views. And they can specify, you know, email address of the recipient who they want to share data with. And then they can choose the mode of sharing. If I want to share that data via copy, for example, do I want to provide a copy of the data to my recipient, or do I just want to allow them to access the data directly at the source? And then finally, they can specify terms of use. So then the data share service will be sending an invitation email to the data recipient, who will then log into their own Azure account and then look at the invitation. You know, if they choose to accept it, they can specify a target Azure data store, whether it's Blob Storage or a SQL data warehouse, to receive or view the data. And then, you know, through the data share dashboard or user interface, both sides can see, you know, what data has been shared with who and when data has left the organization. So they have the full visibility of, you know, all the sharing relationships, and they can revoke access anytime they want.
One question with that, is that also writable? So when you say share, does that mean it's only read-only, or is it also writable?
Yeah, it's read only. So most of the customers that we're talking to, you know, they're looking to share data more in a read only fashion. We do have some customers that, let's say, just to give you an example, in the analytics outsourcing industry or scenarios. So if I have some data that I collected from my customer and I want to get that analyzed, but I don't know how to process that data. Maybe I don't have the resource or the know-how. So I outsource the analytics to a third party. So in this case, you know, the data will be shared through Azure Data Share to that third party analytics firm. And after they process the data, they have the analytics results, which will then be shared back to me. So it's like a two-way sharing relationship that, you know, they're using Data Share for.
And when you talk about the sharing, the one thing that I haven't heard is you saying anything about exporting or importing. This data still lives in whatever service it normally sits in, you know, SQL Data Warehouse or SQL Azure or Blob or whatever. Like the customers don't have to move this anywhere to take advantage of this, right?
Actually, we support two modes of sharing. The first mode is what we call snapshot-based sharing. So a copy of the data is provided from the data provider to a data consumer. If you think about today's data sharing methodology, you know, FTP, secure FTP, API, it's all copy-based. So the recipient essentially gets a copy of the data. So a lot of our customer actually using copy-based sharing or snapshot-based sharing that's offered by the data share service. The other mode of sharing is what we call in-place sharing. So you know, if you think about in the software world, we call this reference or pointers. So the way it works is we establish a symbolic link between the source data store that is in the data provider's Azure tenant and the target data store that is in the data consumer's Azure tenant. So we establish the symbolic link so that the data consumer or recipient, they can access the data in their Azure tenant where the data is physically only stored in the provider's Azure tenant. So why are we doing both? The first use case I've talked about, you know, this is essentially how everybody's doing today. But with in-place sharing, it really enables a lot of new opportunities when you need to do real-time data processing. So for example, in IoT industry, you know, you just talked about the IoT sending recipes to coffee machines. We're actually seeing a lot of increased usage of IoT in automotive industry, in manufacturing industry, where the equipment provider, they actually, you know, install those IoT devices, let's say, in a manufacturing plant, right, of their customer. And then those data about the equipment needs to be streamed back to the equipment provider in real time so that they can do analytics to make sure that all the devices are healthy. And in this case, you really need to have real-time access to the data. And this is really where in-place sharing is providing that, you know, when you have the data available in the source and then in the target data store, they can see the data directly. So today, you know, we already support in-place sharing for Azure Data Explorer, which is, you know, used in, you know, IoT industry, used for collecting telemetry and logs data, and over time we'll be expanding to other Azure data stores.
Yeah, no, that's great. Because I actually wasn't even thinking about the second scenario, but mm-hmm. but yeah, I mean, so this is awesome because customers don't have to do any, you know, import, export or anything. It's staying, they can snapshot it like you were talking about or provide read-only access, but either way, it's still in the original service, right? They don't have to do anything special to make this happen. That's great.
So in the case when we do the snapshot or the copy-based, how do we take into account data sovereignty requirements, right? Like customers, some customers don't want their data leaving the United States, or maybe they don't want it leaving Europe for that matter. Is that kind of allowed for inside of the service?
Yeah, so, you know, behind the scene, you know, we actually bring up compute resources to provide copy of the data. That is one thing that we're going to be working on is to, because we know where's the source and where's the target, so we can kind of lock down, you know, where we spin up these compute resources to actually move the data. It's something that today it's best effort. Typically, let's say if you're sharing from US to US, it is, you know, the data is not going to go to a third country. But in the future, we're looking to lock it down further.
Got it.
So for customers that have a on-prem presence, is there any way they can take advantage of Azure Data Share if they're hoping to still share their data even within their own environment or with other mm-hmm. customers or other recipients?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We actually get that question quite a lot. So today, so first of all, you know, let's say if they want to share with a third party, what we have seen, you know, where some customers, they do have their data on-prem. So they first, they'll ingest the data into Azure using things like Azure Data Factory, and then they use Azure Analytics tool to process the data prior to sharing so they can take advantage of all the Azure Analytics services. And once the data is shared on the recipient side, you know, because the data is in an Azure data store, they can pretty much hook up any Azure Analytics tools to the data to start processing the data right away. So this is what we've seen some of the customers are doing. And we're initially focusing on Azure to Azure sharing because we really want to, you know, first help out Azure customers to enhance their analytics data sets. The other question actually you're asking is more about, you know, interdepartmental sharing within the same organization. And we are seeing actually quite a number of customers asking us, hey, can we, you know, use data share to share data between different departments? So, for example, my department has this data set. Maybe another department within my company wants to get access to and process that data. But I just don't want to grant them you know, direct access to my Azure data store. So that, and I want them to pay for their own compute, right, and processing. So in this use case, you know, today, some of our customers, they will have these data sets in an Azure data store that is only accessible to VNet. So with SQL-based sharing, you know, you can check a box to essentially say enable access to other Azure services, which will allow them to share that data through Azure Data Share. We're working on something similar with the storage team.
What about the performance? Is there different tiers or anything like that? Like, what could customers expect, especially like in a copy scenario?
Yeah.
You said they're spinning up a compute node. What kind of performance should they expect to receive? And is there ways to adjust that or anything?
Right. So today we're actually spinning up, you know, compute node on behalf of the customer. So and it's more automated today. So customer don't have to dial to say, you know, if I want a 2-core machine or a 32-core machine. But in the future, we're thinking to expose that to let customer to control it. So really, depending on, you know, the if you're sharing across the data center, within the same data center, and the amount of data. With terabytes of data, we did some performance benchmarking. It can, you know, take about, you know, around 30 minutes, you know, anywhere between 30 to 40 minutes to move terabytes of data. So that gives you an idea of the kind of performance. The other thing I want to mention is with file-based sharing, that's where you see, you know, majority of our customers are actually still sharing files. And this is where you can get to, you know, terabytes or multi-terabytes of data. What we do is incremental snapshots. So we don't always copy like all the files again every day, let's say, if you want to share time series data. So the way it works is, let's say if you're sharing a folder, which you use to store all your point of sales data, let's say in the retail industry, right? They share point of sales data with their consumer goods supplier. So the consumer goods supplier can take that data to do forecasting or inventory planning. And that data comes in on a daily basis. So, you know, maybe today you have three files in your source folder that you're sharing, and tomorrow you added one file and you modified, you know, one file, and we will only copy the two file, the modified file and the new file. So, you know, instead of like copying everything. So that really helps you to kind of reduce the amount of data that needs to be copied and also to save cost.
This is great, Jay. So is this already released or is it still in preview or something? What's the status right now?
Yeah, so the service has GA'd. So we actually went from public preview to GA very quickly. So we launched back in July and the service GA'd in November at Ignite. But we do have, you know, new capabilities that we're rolling out. And for new capabilities, usually, you know, they will go through a preview phase before we GA that capability. So the first capability we rolled out is snapshot or copy-based sharing for ADLS Gen 2 and blob storage. So those capability has GA today. We also recently added support for snapshot-based sharing for SQL Data Warehouse, or now Synapse Analytics. So those capabilities are in public preview. And we have also launched support for in-place sharing for Azure Data Explorer, you know, for the real-time analytics scenario. And that was just launched in November, and that is also in preview today.
Okay, and I suppose the pricing is kind of like a blend of like storage and compute that you have to do on the user's behalf. Is that how it's calculated?
Yeah, so the pricing is really, you know, right now we only have pricing model for the snapshot-based sharing, you know, and that is related to really the amount of resource that is required to move the data or copy the data. So we charge by, you know, by the amount of compute that is required to move the data, as well as we charge a fee for every time you make a data movement. So that is the pricing model for snapshot-based sharing. For in-place sharing, this is something still new and still in preview, so we haven't finalized pricing model for that yet. But the goal for the service is really to, you know, make data sharing easy for our customers in Azure. So you can think about that way, you know, when we come up with pricing model.
I think I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask just in case, because I'm sure customers are going to have it. You know, you talked about being able to track permissions and manage permissions and everything. Azure Active Directory as authentication, as the authorization authentication mechanism is fully supported here, right? Or is that the primary mechanism, or is there, can I use, you know, am I restricted to other authentication means, or is it mostly AD and integrated?
Yeah, it's mostly AD integrated. Actually, the customers we talked to, you know, they really wanted AD based authentication. So the way it works is there's no exchange of credential between the data provider and the data consumer. So how do we get access to the provider's, let's say, storage account to read the data we use the managed service identity or managed identity.
Okay.
Of the data share resource on the provider side to do the read. And then on the consumer side, we use the managed identity of the data share resource in the consumer's tenant to do the write. So this is how, you know, we are able to share data without any exchange of credentials between the two parties.
That's great.
Yeah.
While you were talking, I just fired up my Azure portal and I just typed data shares and I saw that the service was, is that how users should go and take advantage of this?
Yeah, that's exactly how you should be using it. Just go directly to Azure portal and search for data share and you'll be able to start using the product. And I assume that I can include a link to a documentation as part of the podcast. Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah, please do. Any other questions for Gia before we let it go, guys?
No, this is great. Thank you, Gia.
Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, or just want to connect, find us on Twitter at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixer.org under the Creative Commons license. We hope you'll tune in again soon to keep learning with us.